Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. I'm John Fardy, and we're going to do something a little different this week on the show. Last summer, me and Mark Ryle took a look at our favourite movie scenes, and it was wildly popular. This week, I'm going to take a look with Mark at the best road movies. That's right, the best road movies of all time. A very subjective list, but hopefully it's one you'll partially agree with or disagree wildly with. You can text us on 53106. You can tweet me, John_Fardy. Or you can email us, screentime@newstalk.com. Mark Ryle, how are you?
I'm good, John. How are you doing?
I'm good. Are you ready to take to the road with me?
Vroom, vroom.
Yes, very good. Well said. I told you to say that and you did. Well done. Take a listen to this.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure. And whatever comes our way.
Steppenwolf. And the sound of, I think everyone thinks of that as a road movie, the soundtrack of Easy Rider, which is kind of the mother of the genre. But I actually think it's, you know, culturally significant and all that. It's a weird film. I'm not sure if it would be in my top five. It's one of those things that's kind of important in the history of kind of culture with Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda and Jack Nicholson. But it's actually kind of a... It's not a movie I'm wild about when I rewatched it a while ago. Mark, have you seen Easy Rider?
Would you believe I haven't seen Easy Rider? I've seen bits of it, obviously, over the years, but I've never actually sat down and watched it from start to finish. I suppose I've never really felt the need.
Yeah, I guess you haven't. It's worth a watch, but I just don't think it's the greatest movie that people make it out to be. It's slight, yeah. Kind of, about these guys who steal drug money or sell drugs and go across America and take more drugs and past, you know, the monument museums and or Mount Rushmore and stuff like that. But yeah, it's a weird movie. Anyway, are you a fan of road movies?
Bunch of goddamn hippies. I do. I mean, it depends on the road movie, obviously. But I do. I love them. Most, I suppose. The allure is that, you know, all movies present us with characters who are on a journey, but it's usually, you know, a metaphorical one, but the road movie is a very literal journey. And it's odd that there isn't more written about the road movie, because it should be enormously appealing, because what do we look for in a movie? We like goals, and we like watching characters with definite clear-cut goals. And the road movie is quintessentially goal oriented. And it's also usually about an outsider who has rejected society and authority. And I suppose you could say that the road movie is a genre with an extremely conservative outlook, because it usually ends quite badly for the authority rejecting outsider. But it's preceded by a journey of optimism and a sense of hope, and the open road stretching into the vanishing point that symbolizes opportunity and possibility. And another huge part of the appeal of the road movie is that there's no choice really but to shoot on location. And a green screen in a studio is no substitute for, you know, a natural landscape shot in widescreen.
Well said. And also what I really like about them is that they're in a car, or they're in a small vehicle, you know, sometimes a plane or a motorbike or whatever, and it brings, you know, sometimes the action and the emotional drama right into your face, because these people are stuck together. Like if you think of When Harry Met Sally, which kind of begins as a road movie, even though it certainly isn't a road movie, but they're in the car and it puts this, you know, pressure or spotlight on the actual conversation. So it can be a very good device, you know, for framing dialogue and framing action.
Yeah. I mean, you can pick really anything, and on some level it's a road movie. Like The Wizard of Oz is probably a road movie, and John Ford's Stagecoach is a road movie before there was roads.
Yeah.
And Apocalypse Now is a road movie on a river. So it's very versatile.
Are you about to say something profound like all life is a road?
No.
No, good. Because I thought you might beat me to it, you know. Life is a highway. Isn't that a terrible song? Life is a highway. I want to ride it all night. Yeah. Tom Cochrane, I think it is, isn't it?
Love is a boat.
Love. Anyway, okay. Well, that's a little sub. And I should say, now, I'm not sure about you and cars, but I'm not really a petrol head. No. So I we're not going to, well, certainly from my point of view, wax too lyrical about the vehicles that they travel in, because I'm not up on my, I'm not a gearhead. Are you?
No. I certainly am not.
No. And you're not into sport either.
I judge cars by their color.
Yeah. You're not into sport either.
No, certainly not.
No, as regular listeners know,
I haven't got the time.
No, absolutely. Too busy watching movies. Okay, well, I'm going to kick things off and I'm going to play a quick clip of the first road movie I've kind of put in my best screen time road movies. Take a listen to this.
Can I give you some advice? Well, I'm going to give it to you anyway. I don't want you making the same mistakes I made when I was young.
Can we hear this?
Dwayne, that's your name, right? Dwayne, this is the voice of experience talking. Are you listening? F*** a lot of women, Dwayne.
Hey.
Not just one woman.
Dad.
A lot of women.
That's enough, right?
Are you getting any?
Dad.
You can tell me, Dwayne. Are you getting any?
Come on, please.
No? Jesus.
You what?
15? My God, man. For the whole world.
Hey, Dad, that's enough. Stop
it. Will you kindly not interrupt me, Richard?
Hey, I will pull this truck over right now.
So pull the truck over. You're not going to shut me up. You can say what I want. I still got Nazi bullets in my ass.
Ah, the Nazi bullets.
That was the wonderful Alan Arkin there, arguing with Greg Kinnear about the Nazi bullets in his ass from Little Miss Sunshine. And the road vehicle in that question, even though we're not petrol heads, as we said, is a kind of camper van, a WV. And if you haven't seen Little Miss Sunshine, it is a joy full of pathos and wonder. All about Greg Kinnear as the patriarch of a family who are falling apart. He is trying to get himself going as a self-styled kind of business guru advisor, and that's not really happening and it's falling apart. His father, who is the grandfather in the family, Alan Arkin, has been kicked out of his retirement home for drug abuse, and he's now back living with the family. Toni Collette is a suffering wife who's dealing with her children. Her youngest daughter wants to be in a Little Miss Sunshine contest. Her eldest boy, played brilliantly by Paul Dano, has stopped speaking because he's reading Nietzsche and he wants to become a fighter pilot. Enter the scene is a brilliant Steve Carell, who has undergone severe trauma because his love life is falling apart. So is his academic career. And they all end up in this van that I mentioned, and they're going to go across America to enter Olive, the youngest girl, into this Little Miss Sunshine pageant. Alan Arkin is in sparkling, wonderful form. The family falls apart, or is falling apart when we meet them, but they come together, as so often is the case, beset with tragedy, on this road journey. Alan Arkin won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. He's quite simply brilliant in it, as is everyone in it, from Toni Collette to Greg Kinnear. Do you like Little Miss Sunshine?
I'm a super freak. It's amazing. I'll never forget the first time I saw Little Miss Sunshine, and I was watching that bit with Abigail Breslin at the pageant through my fingers. I couldn't look at the screen, but oh God, it was I couldn't look away either.
Abigail is brilliant as the young girl who really shouldn't be going to this pageant, you know. And yeah. Do you agree though, Alan Arkin is wonderful.
He's tremendous. Unfortunately, he's not in it for a lot.
As he should be, yeah. But he still won an Oscar for the bits of it he was in.
I think at the time it was an unusual role for Steve Carell. It was a lot more subdued than the kind of thing that he had been used to doing. He was kind of in that Jim Carrey kind of space.
Well,
so
that
it was a lot. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, that's what I wanted to say in closing on Little Miss Sunshine. It's my favorite Steve Carell performance, even though I enjoy him in a lot of stuff that's comedic. This is his best, I would say, performance all around, dramatic, comedic, otherwise, because he's heartbroken about life. He doesn't want to be back in this dysfunctional family, but he finds solace in it in ways he never expected. And he brings a world-weary melancholia and later joy to proceedings that I've never seen him do before or since, really.
Absolutely, yeah. Less is more.
Yeah, and he constantly refers him to himself as the America's leading expert on Proust in a very ironic way, which I liked a lot, you know. So that's Little Miss Sunshine. Okay. You should watch if you haven't seen it. It's a brilliant movie, not just a road movie, but they are very much on the road in this, and they are brilliant on that road. Mark, let's go without further ado to your first choice as a road movie you enjoy.
My first pick is Paper Moon from 1973.
Can we take a clip of it quickly?
Please.
Ain't she a sweet child?
No, she ain't a sweet child.
Well, maybe she don't seem sweet right now. That's because she's sad. That is, with her mama being dead, but with your brother getting drunk and driving into that tree like that.
What are you trying to pull? Get out of here.
Get out of here.
All right, I'm going, but let me tell you where I'm going to go.
I don't care where you're going to go.
I'm going to go see Mr. J.T. Faraday.
Now, you know who Mr. J.T. Faraday is? Well, he's one of the biggest lawyers in Kansas, and he don't favor the man with the money. He favors the man without it. And you know what's going to happen to your brother? There's going to be a lawsuit against him. You know what happens then? Everything's going to be just tied up in knots, just sitting there. That's his banking money, his house, everything he owns, including half this plant. Now, don't think that poor child ain't entitled, because she is. Now, I was thinking a couple of $1,000 would be acceptable.
A couple of thousand? I'll give you $200.
$200? $200. It's a deal.
There we had Ryan O'Neill. Why do you love this, Mark?
It's in a word, Tatum O'Neill. I suppose I'll explain what it's about. Yeah. Ryan O'Neill is Moses Prey. He's a petty con man, and he gets saddled with the 9-year-old Addie Loggins, who may or may not be his daughter. And the goal here is for Moses to deliver Addie to her relatives in Missouri, but he hasn't agreed to do this out of the goodness of his heart. He's using Addie so that he can extort $200 through blackmail, but then he ends up owing the $200 to her, so he ends up stuck with her until he can pay her off. And they start off doing these low level cons and grifts. But it's not a clever kind of con man movie. The con is really just an in, and it's an excuse to build on this bond between maybe father and maybe daughter. And it's from Peter Bogdanovich, and his previous movie was What's Up Doc, which is a screwball comedy, and it was a weird follow-up to The Last Picture Show. But Paper Moon is a much more down-to-earth and grounded movie than What's Up Doc was. It's shot in black and white, and it looks like a movie from the 1940s, but it's a very, very modern movie, and it hasn't dated all that much, and the dialogue is razor sharp, and it's very contemporary. You can tell that it was an influence on the Coen brothers' early stuff, and I think there's a definite thread running through Madeline Kahn's character in this, and what Frances McDormand is doing in something like Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
I can't remember where or when I first saw Paper Moon, but I was young enough to have my mind blown by the sight of Tatum O'Neill smoking fags and driving a car. And
because she's nine at this stage in her life?
She is nine, and she is, obviously, she is Ryan O'Neill's daughter in real life.
Yes.
And I'm sorry to say that neither Ryan O'Neill or Tatum O'Neill were ever better, which is very, very sad. And obviously Tatum O'Neill's had problems in her life that are well documented. Yeah. And a lot of them were down to her relationship with her dad, who doesn't sound like he was the greatest father on the planet. But she is just tremendous in this. She just oozes complete confidence, and she's an absolute natural. And she quite rightly won the Oscar, Best Supporting Actress Oscar, I think in 1974 for this. But it's a shame that she never followed it up with anything that was as good afterwards. But the dialogue is so funny. Ryan O'Neill says at one point, "I've got scruples. You know what scruples are, don't you?" And she replies, "No, but if you got them, it's a sure bet they belong to somebody else." It's really funny stuff.
Yeah, and I was rewatching clips of it last night. I'd actually forgotten it was in black and white. And so Tatum O'Neill won an Oscar for this, right? Best Supporting Actress it was.
Yeah, she was the youngest at the time, I think. It's just it's Tatum O'Neill's confidence. Mm. It's just it just comes through the screen.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
Ryan O'Neill is very good in it as well. It must be said.
He is. Yeah. Absolutely. They both are, which is odd considering the weird relationship they had off screen.
Absolutely. Who did Tatum O'Neill end up married to in the end?
I think she was married to John McEnroe.
She was married to John McEnroe. I'm trying to think. Did I interview her father, Ryan? Or her husband. Well, I didn't interview John McEnroe. I think I
interviewed... You didn't do them both at the same time.
No.
Ryan O'Neill and John McEnroe.
No. I. Who was in... Was Ryan O'Neill in the movie shot in Ireland by Stanley Kubrick?
Oh, Barry Lyndon.
Was Ryan O'Neill and Barry Lyndon?
Yeah, he was. He was the lead.
That is it. I was momentarily confused there. I'm not going to edit this out, folks. I was having a real moment there. But I did interview Ryan O'Neill when he was back in Ireland for a special showing, I think at the Dublin Film Festival, of Barry Lyndon. And
yeah.
He was a charismatic guy, but a strange guy, I remember.
Yeah. Probably a fair assessment of
that. Yeah, charismatic but strange. But look, Paper Moon is a wonderful choice, and it's definitely a road movie as well, because they are, as you say, she drives the car at one stage in the movie, wonderfully so as well. Now, I wanted to go to a movie that I think is a hidden gem in some ways, and that's Midnight Run. And what I'm talking about here is Robert De Niro doing comedy, which often can put people off because sometimes he misses a trick. But in this, he's playing a kind of bounty hunter who's bringing an accountant who's ripped the mob off into a bonds bailsman across the country, and the accountant is played brilliantly by Charles Grodin, and they're on planes, they're on the road, they're on a train, they may even be on a river at one stage. There's helicopters involved. It is hilarious. It is a buddy movie. There's also a lot of heart in it as well. And I really think it's where Robert De Niro got that blend of doing comedy, but also being Robert De Niro that we love as well. There are so many memorable scenes in it. I want to bring you a quick one here where he and Charles Grodin are discussing a possible friendship that's grown between them because they hate each other at the start.
What's with you and that watch? What is it with the watch? You told me when you get to know me better, you told me about your feelings for chickens. I mean, how private could the watch be? What's the big secret?
Now, Gail bought me this watch. She gave it to me. It was the first thing she ever gave me. She bought it because I was always late, at least a half an hour. So she bought it and set it ahead a half an hour so I'd never be late. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I keep thinking we're going to wind up together again. I don't know why. I'm still hanging on. I'm still waiting around.
I don't think she's coming back.
Yeah, I don't either.
Sometimes you just have to let go. Just get yourself a new watch. You're okay, Jack. I think under different circumstances, you and I probably still would have hated each other.
Charles Grodin there and Robert De Niro in Midnight Run, which I'm nominating as one of the best road movies ever. It's a kind of undiscovered gem. People adore it. It's a classic. Mark, have you seen it? Do you like it?
I've seen Midnight Run more times than it's probably healthy.
Oh, so you like it that much?
I love it, yeah. I think Charles Grodin is my spirit animal. my knowledge of the bizarre Bond system comes from Midnight Run and Dog the Bounty Hunter.
Yeah.
And it ends there. I think it's worth remembering that Robert De Niro doing a comedy in 1987 was an entirely different prospect to Robert De Niro doing a comedy in 2021.
Yeah, absolutely. In that people didn't know what to expect.
No, in that he wasn't known for it.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah.
unfortunately, he is now, and it hasn't gone well.
It hasn't gone well a lot of the times. It's not always a failure, but he was never better in a mildly comedic role than he was in Midnight Run. And it's also, you know, that stereotype of an unlikely buddy movie, and it's brilliant. And it was actually hard to find a clip without any swear words in it as well. Yeah. I should mention. And I'm did sure you know it. Bob Moffat, yeah, who plays an LA cabbie in Midnight Run? It's in the final scene, but it doesn't matter. He was also alongside Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver. There you go.
I did not.
Yeah, you were going to say something else about Midnight Run.
I was going to say the amount of, I'm sure there's an interesting made-for-TV edit of Midnight Run somewhere with all the cussing.
Yeah,
cut out of it.
There's a serious amount of cussing. It's good cursing in it, though, in that it's like the swear words are used as almost adjectives and word breaker uppers. You know, they have a serious point in terms of what they're doing in the movie. Now, that is Midnight Run. Let's take a quick break. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Something a little different this week. Me and my partner in crime, Mark Ryle, are detailing some of our favourite road movies. We'd love to hear from you. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Before the break, we were talking about Midnight Run, Paper Moon, Little Miss Sunshine. I was saying that I thought Easy Rider was slightly overrated. How dare I? But there you go. As I say, Mark Ryle is with me. He's in the house. He's in effect. He's pumped. Mark, give me another road movie that you particularly enjoy.
The next one I'm going to talk about is The Sugarland Express from 1974. I really don't need any excuse to talk about Steven Spielberg. And The Sugarland Express was his first theatrical release, even though I think his first movie, Jewel, it was a made-for-TV movie, but it did get released into cinemas after the fact. Mm-hmm. But with The Sugarland Express, you can tell that Spielberg is kind of still developing his style and honing his craft, and it's a lot more rough around the edges than what we would become used to. It is about a pair of jailbirds, Lou Jean and Clovis Poplin, played by Goldie Hawn and William Atherton. And while they have both been in prison, social services has taken their two-year-old and placed him with a foster family. So she breaks him out of jail to go rescue their son. And to cut a long story short, they end up hijacking a highway patrol car and taking a cop hostage. And what follows is the longest, slowest chase involving what must be close to a couple of hundred police cars. I can't imagine what the logistics of setting this up were. And even like resetting for another take, it must have been an absolute nightmare. Goldie Hawn and William Atherton, they really are rubbish fugitives, and there's not much forward planning here at all or any thought of consequences. And Goldie Hawn's character in particular is very much living in the now. And there's lots of nice bits of business here, and there's lots of, you know, throwaway jokes that kind of all get thrown into the stew. But it is obvious that this is Spielberg evolving as a director and learning his trade on the job. And he uses a lot of the same staging and framing and tricks like the dolly zoom that he'll use again in stuff like Close Encounters and E.T. It was the first collaboration with John Williams as well. And obviously he has worked with Spielberg many, many times over the years, and which resulted in some of the finest musical scores ever, inarguably. But The Sugarland Express probably isn't Williams' finest hour. But yeah, it's an interesting beginning, I would describe The Sugarland Express as.
Well, Have you seen it? Well, you see, that's what I was going to say to you. I was going to be honest, because I always am. I've never seen The Sugarland Express, but I was wondering, and I know obviously what it is, and it's early Spielberg. So are you just saying that it's an okay road movie, and really what's of interest here is that it's Spielberg in utero, kind of?
It is, yeah. I think it's overlooked oftentimes. It would be, you like, not a lot of people would have, you know, sought it out, you know what I mean?
Mm, yeah.
It's worth
sussing out.
It is. There's an awful lot here that's, you know, some of the action is, you can see him, you know, getting ready to do it bigger, but it's an interesting movie.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, well, I definitely might check it out. And I suppose, you know, it sounds though it might be slightly one that if you're very interested in Spielberg and cinephile-y stuff, that it might be more appealing, like as in you can see where he's going to.
Perhaps it's one for completists.
Yes, which you certainly are. Without a question. Now, take a listen to this.
Thelma, I'm going to Mexico. Now, I figure I can make it in 2.5 days, but I'm going to have to haul ass. Are you up to this? I mean, I got to know. This isn't a game. I'm in deep shit, and I got to know what you're going to do.
I don't know. I don't know, Louise. I mean, I don't know what you're asking.
Now, don't you start flaking out on me. God damn it, Thelma. Every time we get in trouble, you just get blank or pleading sanity. It's not this time. I mean, this time, things have changed. Everything's changed. But I'm going to Mexico. I'm going.
Now, that was, of course, a clip of Thelma and Louise. And I suppose, you know, at the time, it was described as a feminist road movie. And in a way, that's accurate, but it also does it a disservice. You know, it kind of minimizes the reach of the movie. So it's a story of a browbeaten housewife played brilliantly by Gina Davis and her, I suppose, sardonic, world-weary waitress best friend, Susan Sarandon, who just embark on a weekend getaway, but then it turns into classic road movie stuff where they're fleeing the law. There's a lot of stuff going on, obviously about gender, but racial and class lines. But, you know, to this day, it really resonates as, you know, I suppose girls, women in search of the American dream and the harsh reality. That's what I like about it as a road movie, in a way that you have the dream of the road, but also what often the road means for a lot of people. And it's a far cry from the open road of some of the movies that we've seen over the years. And in a way, it nearly deconstructs the road movie in that way, you know. And I love Sarandon and Davis in it. And I also love the end scene, which I won't give away, but it's a brilliant ending to a movie. And Ridley Scott's on fire as a director in a movie. What do you think, Mark?
It's a gutsy move. I'm not sure if it's possible to spoil Thelma and Louise at this stage, but I suppose it goes back to that thing I was talking about earlier, where, you know, these characters are made to pay for their transgressions. So you could say that it's quite a conservative outlook.
In some respects,
I mean, it was hard hitting at the time.
Yeah, and of course it had Brad Pitt looking beautiful and kind of launched his career, and he's good in it. The small part he's in it, it has to be said.
He started off great, and then he kind of dipped, and now he's kind of come back around the other side of it.
Oh, you mean in terms of his career? You don't mean in the movie?
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay. I'm not talking about his short. One scene in the...
Yeah,
in
no, he wasn't in it long enough, yeah. I really do like Thelma and Louise, I have to say. It's a great road movie. So if you're just tuned in, me and Mark Ryle are discussing some of our favourite and indeed the most important road movies. Mark, why don't you give us another one of your picks?
I seem to be moving chronologically. So my next choice is Paris, Texas from 1984. This was based on a short story by Sam Shepard. And for me, it's the quintessential, not only the quintessential road movie, but it's the quintessential Wim Wenders movie. Mm. Wenders had an affinity with road movies, and he started off his career with a trilogy, including Alice in the Cities and Kings of the Road. But he returned to the genre many, many times throughout the 1970s and the 1980s. Also, when I think of the road movie, I really think of Harry Dean Stanton, who sadly passed away in 2017.
And we'll be mentioning again in another movie soon.
Yeah, indeed. But Harry Dean Stanton had one of those faces where you could read his entire history in his face. Here he plays Travis. And at the start of the movie, Travis wanders out of the desert mute with amnesia. And it transpires that 4 years previously, Travis had a dissociative episode that saw him walk out on his 3-year-old son and his wife. And the goal here is reconnection and atoning for his past transgressions and making good. And the theme, if you like, is the difficulty of communication. Mm. And Paris, Texas is a film in three distinct acts. The first act is Travis trying to reconnect with his brother, who's played by Dean Stockwell. And then the second is Travis reconnecting with his son.
Yeah.
And then the final act is Travis trying to reconnect with his estranged wife, who's played to devastating effect by Nastassja Kinski. Mm-hmm. And there's a long scene towards the end of the movie with Harry Dean Stanton and Nastassja Kinski. And if it doesn't break you, I think there's something wrong. I watched this a few days ago.
Oh.
And it really is, it's just a pleasure. I've forgotten what a joy this film is. I don't want to get all old man yells at cloud, but they really don't make them like this anymore. And what Wim Wenders has done here with Paris, Texas is he brings this European art house aesthetic to a very American genre. And things are given as much time as they need and nothing is rushed. And it's quite hypnotic, you know. It also looks gorgeous. It's a really good looking movie.
Yeah. Well, we had cause to revisit it on this show a little while ago when Professor Richard Carney, the philosopher, chose it as his favorite movie. And we got a great reaction to it. I really enjoy it as a movie as well. I mean, I think it's good to watch movies like this to remind ourselves that occasionally they can be done different ways. It isn't always an easy watch. It's quite arty, but it's trying to show you stuff, not in a whack in the face way. I mean, it's a commitment. It's a great commitment, and it looks beautiful, but it's not a, maybe I'm doing it a disservice, but it's not an easy movie maybe to get straight into.
I don't know. I think, well, I suppose it, as I said, it's quite hypnotic, but it can take its while to get where it's going. But that final scene with Nastassja Kinski just destroys me.
I hear you. And the relationship with the son is can be a hard watch as well, in a good way.
That kid is amazing. I think he was 8 at the time, but another Tatum O'Neill.
A brilliant actor. Wonderful. That's Paris, Texas, Mark describing very well there, the Wim Wenders movie. We're looking at some of the best road movies, and that is very much a road movie because it's all desert scenes, and Harry Dean Stanton is always traveling somewhere, from my memory of it.
Yeah, and the skies are so blue, they look almost artificial.
Yeah, the skies are beautiful and the desert scenes are beautiful as well. Well worth a watch. Well, listen, let me go to the next one, and we mentioned Harry Dean Stanton from 1999, and that's The Straight Story, David Lynch. Now, I don't know if people have seen this or not, but this was David Lynch. Well, it was actually the screenwriter. He didn't write the script, but giving him this story, which was a real life story of a case he read about, and I think it might have been in Ohio, about a brother who hadn't spoken to another brother in a long time and heard he was sick and got on a lawnmower, a John Deere lawnmower, and went hundreds of miles to meet his brother all through the American Midwest. And he's on a lawnmower, like a John Deere lawnmower, and you've odd things happen to him along the way. And what I love about this in a way is that it doesn't feel like a normal David Lynch movie. I mean, a Lynch movie can be so many things, but this is quite literally, and it's such a great title because the character's name is, his surname was Straight in the story, but it is a straight story in terms of Lynch telling a more conventional story in terms of him, but it's also a straight story as in it's someone going straight from A to B on a road, even though there are lots of side roads and cul-de-sacs along the way. It's a remarkable movie. Do you agree, Mark?
Absolutely, yeah. Richard Farnsworth, wasn't it?
Yeah, Richard Farnsworth.
Yeah, he's brilliant. I suppose you can't talk about road movies without talking about David Lynch. It was either going to be this or Wild at Heart.
Yeah, which is a wonderful David Lynch road movie as well.
But I suppose this is, David Lynch saying, you want straight, I'll give you straight.
Yeah, absolutely.
there's no dream sequences and no heavy symbolism. And, you know, sometimes a lawnmower is just a lawnmower.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots going on, but it is a movie in a way devoid of all the normal things that we love about David Lynch, and it shows that he can tell literally a straight story. And Alvin Straight, of course, I should have said that was his, that's the name of the actual guy who the movie was based on. Yeah, Lynch Without Lynch, a wonderful movie. If you've just tuned in, me and Mark Ryle are taking a look at some of our favourite road movies and movies we hope you enjoy too. If you'd like to get in touch or add your tuppence worth, you can email us screentime@newstalk.com or you can tweet me John_Fardy. Mark, we better take a quick break. Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. I'm John Fardy. This week we're doing something slightly different. Me and Mark Ryle are taking a look at some of our favourite road movies. If you'd like to get involved, you can email us screentime@newstalk.com or you can tweet me, John_Fardy. Before the break, I was talking about The Straight Story, Thelma and Louise, and also Mark's choice of Paris, Texas by Wim Wenders. As I say, do get in touch if there's anything you'd like to point out that we're missing or not talking about or anything you don't agree with. Mark, I'm going to go a bit Irish now. There are Irish road movies, and this is not just one of the best Irish road movies ever, but one of the best Irish movies ever.
I'm in complete agreement.
Did you ever make love to a gangster's wife? Jeez, you can't really enjoy yourself. I mean, no, I'm not saying. I mean, she's a smashing little board, French's missus.
I don't really want to hear this, Frank.
Do anything, dear. Do anything. And there you are, relaxing, perfectly within your rights. Two consenting adults, having intercourse.
I don't want to hear this, Frank.
And human contact. Very nice. But all the time, like, you're just waiting for them to catch up with you. You have no idea. The fear. It's like making love with the angel of death sitting on your...
Would you shut up? You're jabbering away there like a idiot. I mean, the thing is, like, you know, I mean, we don't know. One, if you're bullshitting us. Two, if you're lying. Three, what is going on? So just give it a rest, all right?
Cool your jets. Only talking.
All you f***ing do is talk.
That was a clip there of I Went Down featuring the great and now sadly departed Tom Caffrey, Peter MacDonald, who is very much alive, and also Brendan Gleeson, who is also very much alive. I Went Down from the late 90s was a road movie all about Brendan Gleeson and Peter MacDonald being unlikely buddies, I guess, who have to go and basically get some stuff back for a henchman and rescue the aforementioned Tom Caffrey there. It's kind of a movie that at the time I felt Irish road movie or Irish movies were kind of trying to show the Celtic Tiger too much or trying to present something. Whereas this is just a straight ahead story of two misfits on the run from things in their own life who go on this madcap, really rural Irish adventure. It's written by Conor McPherson, who I just think is a wonderful playwright, a wonderful writer. It's directed by Paddy Bradnock, who is also a wonderful filmmaker. I don't think, even though Brendan Gleeson has done wonderful stuff, I don't think he's ever been better than he has been as Bunny in I Went Down. Mark, you like I Went Down, I hope.
I love it. I think it's one of the best Irish movies ever.
And good man.
It is. It's really funny. And it's not in a cringy or an okay-ish funny, but I'll give it a chance because it's Irish way. It's genuinely funny. And it's criminal that it is not more widely available.
Yeah.
You're really going to struggle to find I Went Down anywhere. I think it has been on TV, I think, twice over the past couple of months, which is great. But before that, I mean, good luck trying to find it anywhere.
Whenever I watch it, and I watch it about once a year, I go to my DVD copy, which is nice, you know,
You're lucky to have a DVD copy.
Yeah. My wife, it was one of the first DVDs she got me. She knew I loved that movie. And just to go back to the genuinely funny thing, Peter MacDonald, I don't want to just, like, Peter MacDonald is great in it as well. But what's so wonderful is Brendan Gleeson's character, Bunny, he's trying to be at times an intellectual and he just fails miserably. He's not a particularly smart guy and he has these theories that make no sense and he does everything to the power of three. It's like, one, what are you talking about? Two, what's going on? And three, what are you talking about? Now, I'm paraphrasing, but it's brilliant. And there's a brilliant scene in it where he's taking Peter Caffrey out of the bath and he's like, you no good fecker in the bath lying there. Like, he can't quite say what he wants to say. And he has this theory about attractive women and women who aren't attractive that makes no sense whatsoever. And there's a brilliant line in it where, you know, he's talking about wanting to go to the States and Peter MacDonald says to him, have you been to the States? And he's like, yeah, well, no, yeah, like on the telly, you know. I could go down I Went Down rabbit hole here. Incidentally, I Went Down is the first three words of Plato's Republic. as well as all sorts of other things. And that's the level of script writing that Conor McPherson brings to it. And stop me if I've told you this before, but the scariest moment I ever had in a theatre, and I don't go to the theatre half as much as I like, certainly at the moment, but was Conor McPherson's Shining City. It was a play I went to many years ago. And there was a scene in that, and I wasn't alone, where the, and this doesn't happen in the theatre, to my limited experience of it, where the audience audibly gasped like they were in a horror movie. I mean, the whole place went, ah! Like, seriously, he is a brilliant, brilliant writer.
In a good way.
In a brilliant way, in a brilliantly dramatic but scary way. It was incredible. I've never experienced it before or since. It was just unbelievable, because generally people in theatres, unless they're laughing, in my experience, don't do that. But in the production of Shining City I saw, and I think it was The Gate, that happened to the whole audience. Remarkable stuff. As is I Went Down, Remarkable Stuff, which me and Mark are talking about as a wonderful Irish road movie. And we're talking about road movies. Mark, your final choice, I was kind of surprised about. It's very modern.
It's a weird one, isn't it?
Well, but you know, tell the folks at home, Mark.
It is Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, who saw that coming, huh? From Paris, Texas to Mad Max Fury Road.
Well, nobody saw it coming. it's on paper, this sounded like the worst idea ever. It was 30 years since George Miller made the last Mad Max movie, which was the appalling and the none more 80s Beyond Thunderdome. And there really didn't seem to be much of an appetite for bringing the character back. And then it turned out that Mel Gibson was getting recast with Tom Hardy stepping into the title role, and The Omens were not good. But then it came out, and I have never seen anything like this in my life. Now, I know that sounds like exaggeration and hyperbole, but I don't care. If there was ever a movie that deserved exaggeration and hyperbole, it's Fury Road. it's words like, visceral and kinetic were invented for this. As an action movie, Fury Road has some of the most incredible action sequences that has ever been committed to celluloid. And I can't even begin to fathom how some of this stuff was pulled off without someone being seriously wounded or worse. And when you think that almost all of this stuff was done with practical effects, it just boggles the mind. And, you know, earlier I was talking about shooting on location. There is no substitute for practical effects over CG effects at all.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, as I said, I've never seen anything like this in my life. And for a jaded, you know, that says a lot, I think.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And does Tom Hardy work in it for you?
Tom Hardy, he must have, yeah, I mean, he spends a lot of the movie with a garden trowel strapped to his face. I think he must have something in his contract stipulating that he must be allowed to keep his face covered between stuff like this and Dunkirk and The Dark Knight Rises. Yeah. He's marginalized, and that's fine. I mean, in a nutshell, the story is that Charlize Theron is a driver for this post-apocalyptic warlord, which is my favorite kind of warlord. And she has rescued five of his wives, and they've been held in captive and used for breeding. And she's bringing them to this fantasy land. But in essence, it's a 2-hour chase.
Yeah.
But what a chase.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
And a lot of this stuff is ridiculous. And the terminology, the stuff like War Boys and Immortan Joe, it's terrible if you think about it. But George Miller doesn't give us the chance to think about it. It is just relentless. And Miller doesn't let up or take his foot off the gas for a second, you know?
Yeah, and you're right when it comes to warlords. The post-apocalyptic ones are the best kind, really, aren't they?
They are the best, yeah.
You know what's instructive about it, though? And I was thinking about this last week when I was talking about Godzilla versus Kong, that you can't always write off, you know, the fourth part of a movie, because it sounds like, oh God, why are they bringing this back? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or why are they making another sequel? But occasionally what happens is the filmmaker is just given something to do and they pay very little attention to what's gone before. So, you know, you occasionally dismiss these movies at your peril, just because it's a remake or it's a continuation of a story that's long since passed its sell-by date. Now, for having said that, then you look at something like Coming to America 2, and, you know, we're Let's still not. Fending off letters from Eddie Murphy when you reviewed
I don't want to
that
look
the
at
last
Coming
time.
To America
so.
2 ever again.
But is wasn't it, like, as you said at the start, it was wildly surprising what happened with Fury Road.
It's just, it was incredible. I mean, nobody thought that this was going to work until it came out. And it's sheer spectacle. It's just incredible, you know. I mean, I think it helps that the production design was really, really good. And that kind of helps us to buy into the ridiculousness.
Yeah.
But it's just, like, as a spectacle, I think it's peerless.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. I didn't see it coming, you know. But that's the way he is. He can do Paris, Texas, but he can... You know, he can be gritty and he can be pop culturey and, you know, popcorny and all that stuff. So finally then...
High and low brow all at once.
Absolutely. He has many brows on his intellectual face or something like that. So finally then, in our little look this week at the best road movies, before we run out of time, I wanted to mention, because we hadn't really done one of anywhere other than, you know, Ireland or America. So I wanted to mention the great Mexican Y2 Mama Tambien, which is a delightful film, which actually has Diego Luna, Gael Garcia Bernal, and the Spanish actress Maribel Verdú. And this is a glorious movie. And it's also, we forget now, by Alfonso Cuarón, who gave us things like Roma and all, who's celebrated now. This was a good bit earlier in his career, 2001, I think it is. And this is, have you seen this, Mark?
I've never seen it, actually, no.
Oh, well, this is a delightful road movie. You have the two guys who are playing kind of early 20s, maybe late teens. Their girlfriends are going off to Italy and they're going to have a wild summer and they want to do mad stuff, and they basically want to sleep with lots of women, as many women as they can, and be unfaithful to their girlfriends, and which isn't, you know, anything to be admired, but it's that terrible time in youth where they see the world as their oyster. And they're at a wedding and they meet this slightly older woman, Maribel Verdú, who they're completely besotted with, and they almost make up the existence of this beach. And she's a serious health issue, and she is in trouble in her own relationship, and she decides to take up their offer after this wedding and go on a road trip with them. And it's a very erotic movie. The boys are obsessed with her and they try various methods to sleep with her. But it's also a movie about Mexico, that these two boys are clearly middle to upper class, and as they go on this road movie and see different parts of the class system in Mexico, they never address that. The narrator does. But the end of where they get to in this movie, you never quite saw coming. And it is visually and storytelling absolutely delightful. And a great, if you'll pardon the pun in here, a great ride. It is the quintessential road movie. And it has everything we've been talking about in a way. So that's Y2 Mama Tambien, a fantastic road movie by the great Alfonso Cuarón. You haven't seen it, Mark. You have to see it.
I haven't. I'm going to go off immediately and watch it, John.
You should. Well, this has been a special Screen Time where me and Mark Ryle have been looking at our favourite road movies. I hope you've enjoyed it. Do let us know what you've thought about it. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. Our Twitter handle, or my Twitter handle, is John_Fardy. Regular business next week. Mark Ryle, thank you very much.
Thanks, John. I think I need to lie down.
You've earned it.